From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The stove is not just hot, the stove has gone supernova. Ahead on Only a Game, Major League Baseball's off-season to end all off-seasons. Also, a conversation with Oliver Chin, author of The Tao of Yao, insights from basketball's brightest big man, and a holiday competition featuring thousands of fruitcakes. Also ahead, 10-pin enthusiasts pull the Professional Bowlers Association out of the gutter.
We have made 20 years' worth of changes in about 2 years. These are changes that the sports world had made over the last 20 years that the PBA hadn't.
We really feel good about history. We really honor it. We just don't want to live there.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Libya's Muammar Gaddafi has agreed to open his country to international inspections and will dismantle the country's program for developing weapons of mass destruction. President Bush called the decision a sign of progress in Libya.
Libya has begun the process of rejoining the community of nations. And Colonel Gaddafi knows the way forward.
The announcement follows 9 months of secret talks with American and British diplomats. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who had said Libya was on the path to making an atomic bomb, now says the prospect of lifting sanctions against Libya is under consideration.
I believe that we have correctly identified the security threat of the early 21st century. It is the combination of terrorism and the development of nuclear or chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction.
Tomorrow marks the 15th anniversary of the Christmas bombing of a Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland. Libya accepted responsibility for that attack earlier this year and paid out billions of dollars to the families of the 270 victims. In what appears to be a case of mistaken identity, U.S. troops fired on a group of Iraqi policemen stationed at a checkpoint in northeastern Iraq today. A police official says three Iraqi police officers were killed and two others were wounded. The Americans apparently thought the officers were bandits. The Iraqi official says the incident happened about 50 miles south of Kirkuk. The U.S. military has not confirmed the shootings. In a separate incident in the same region overnight, Iraqi authorities say Iraqi police shot and wounded two people who officers say were trying to plant two roadside bombs on a route traveled by U.S. troops. The bombs were defused by American soldiers. Homeland Security officials say a massive counterterrorism exercise last May revealed problems with communications and coordination among emergency responders. NPR's Pam Fessler has more on the story.
The $16 million exercise involved two mock attacks, a radioactive dirty bomb in downtown Seattle and a pneumonic plague attack in Chicago. The purpose was to assess the nation's preparedness to deal with multiple attacks at once. Officials say they were generally pleased with the results, but found that there was some confusion about what to do when the color-coded terror alert level was raised to red, the highest level. There were also problems detecting the spread of radioactive contamination in Seattle, and hospitals in Chicago had problems dealing with a large number of fake casualties. The Department of Homeland Security says it's trying to fix the problems and that the purpose of the exercise was to expose any weaknesses in the system before a real attack occurs. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Talks between negotiators for three major supermarket chains and grocery store workers broke down overnight in Southern California after resuming for just a day. No new talks have been scheduled to end the 10-week-old strike. This is NPR. The Dow Jones Industrials closed out the week at their highest levels in 19 months yesterday. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
Trading was a seesaw affair on a quadruple witching Friday when stock options, index futures, and single stock futures all expired. Wall Street was also briefly on edge after an unconfirmed report of a terrorist threat to New York City. But the Dow managed to end at its highest level since May of last year. The Dow is poised to breach 10,300. The S&P 500 dipped and the technology-heavy NASDAQ composite fell modestly. For the week, the Dow rose nearly 2.5%, its fourth straight weekly gain. The S&P was up 1.4%, while the NASDAQ inched up a tenth. A mix of strong economic numbers, improved profits, and low inflation, as well as the capture of Saddam Hussein, pushed stocks higher despite a plunging U.S. dollar. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Federal health officials are responding to the early flu season by sending response teams to states hit hard by the outbreak and by calling on all health departments to report flu deaths of children. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Julie Gerberding, says 42 children have died from the flu this season. She says the flu is widespread in 36 states. A federal appeals court ruled yesterday the recording industry cannot force internet providers to turn over the names of people who share music files. The ruling does not legalize the distribution of copyrighted songs over the internet, but makes it harder for the recording industry to track them. The music file sharing activity of internet users with hopes of suing them is the proposal of the industry. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Though several Major League Baseball teams, the Orioles, Royals, and Cardinals among them, are no doubt thrilled with the seasonal or off-seasonal gifts they've acquired, the spirit of giving and getting has been foiled in more than one baseball town. The stockings of the Atlanta Braves appear to be empty of everything but coal dust, and poor Alex Rodriguez, all he wanted for Christmas was the opportunity to play for a contender. And apparently he will have to wait for Christmas future, unless he doesn't. ESPN's Tim Kirkjian knows more about all this than I do, of course, and so he joins me now. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Help me with this. The on-again, off-again Alex Rodriguez for Manny Ramirez affair was, depending on whom you believe, permanently off as of Thursday evening after days of negotiations between the teams, Major League Baseball, the Players Association. I think the Pope was involved in it at some point. What do you think is the most likely outcome to this, at least perhaps temporarily dead deal?
I think this trade is going to get done. Everybody involved in this trade either wants it to happen or needs it to happen, and in some cases, both.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the Red Sox needing to do this, the Rangers needing to do this, baseball needing to do this, even the Players Association wanting this to happen. When you put all that together and everybody not necessarily pulling in the right direction, but pulling for the same thing, I think one way or another this can be worked out. But again, there are so many moving parts to this that they all have to be moving at the same time and in the right direction, and that's not going to be easy to do.
Has there ever been a bigger cast of people working to pull off a bigger sports transaction?
Well, I can only speak for baseball, Bill, and I can tell you this. This would be the biggest trade in the history of baseball. And no, I can't imagine more people being involved in one transaction than are involved in this. And not only people, but basically the most important people in the game. The commissioner, one of the heads of the Major League Players Association, arguably the most powerful owner out there, the best player in the game is involved, one of the most popular players in the history of the Red Sox is involved. It just goes on and on and on, and there are days where you just wonder, who do I call first on this one? Who is going to help me the most if I reach them? And I'm not sure I found that person yet.
Some people have contended that adding A-Rod to a roster also featuring newly acquired pitchers Curt Schilling and Keith Foulke would have made the Red Sox the easy favorite for the 2004 pennant. Can they be a favorite with Manny Ramirez and Nomar Garciaparra and that added pitching?
Well, it's going to be much more difficult. One major league manager told me the other day, if they get Alex Rodriguez, the Red Sox will win the World Series, which I know is music to your ears, Bill. And that was before Maglio Ordóñez suddenly appeared on the horizon that he's going to join the Red Sox also,
mm-hmm.
which is another dynamic of this trade, another reason why I think it has to be done, because the Red Sox are looking at adding a player who overall may be slightly better than Manny Ramirez, and they're adding a player who is definitely better than Nomar Garciaparra. And you add those two guys to a team that has already gotten demonstrably better in the offseason with the addition of Keith Foulke and Curt Schilling, and I think it not only makes the Red Sox the team to beat in the American League, it may make them the team to beat in the major leagues if they can pull off this deal, which, is, again, is the reason why the Red Sox are pulling in this direction, because they have now tantalized their fans with the prospect of not just A-Rod, but Magley Ordóñez also.
Well, let's look away from Texas and Boston for a little while. What are the other important changes that have happened around the league to other teams?
Well, I think the Philadelphia Phillies have made the most important changes so far in the offseason, and I think they have gone from a good team to a really good team by acquiring Billy Wagner from the Astros. To me, in many ways, that was a steal, as long as you can say that picking up an $8 million closer is a steal. They've added Eric Milton, who's going to be in their rotation. They have added Roberto Hernandez and Tim Morrell, who are going to help them out in the bullpen. They had a terrible bullpen last year, Bill, and that's basically the reason why they didn't go to the playoffs when they were supposed to. Now they've made their bullpen so good that it's one of the best in the league, and I think they're the most improved team in baseball, pending, of course, what the Red Sox do the rest of this offseason.
You see, we couldn't get through that answer without mention of that, could we?
There's no way to get through any sentence on any topic without coming up somehow with the Red Sox and the Rangers.
Well, absent from all the festivities that we've been discussing is just about every West Coast team. Is this appropriate, or, you know, have they too been lost in the shuffle?
Well, I think they've been lost completely in this, and I think they have themselves to blame. The Giants, for instance, they have to cut payroll, so we'll leave them out of this. The Dodgers, to me, are the real interesting team on the West Coast. The Angels have done some things. The Padres did some things late in the season to make themselves better. The Dodgers really haven't done very much other than trade their best pitcher, Kevin Brown, in order to save some money to go out and get a hitter. Yet they haven't been able to find that hitter, and they've been trying very hard, but it appears they're a little hesitant on the trigger there to make a move and get the hitter or hitters that they need. Naturally, one of those hitters is Nomar Garciaparra. Of course, We can't talk about any other team without talking about the Red Sox, because the Red Sox and the Rangers are involved in everything that's going on in baseball. All sorts of deals are hinged upon whether this one goes through. That's what's so perplexing about it for all the other teams, is they're standing there saying, make the deal so we know what we have to go get. But the Dodgers are trying to get Nomar, but they can't get him, of course, until the A-Rod Manny trade goes off.
Tim Kirkjian follows the staggering gallimaufry of the offseason diamond dealing for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you very much, and again, happy holidays.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Young athletes entering the world of big-time professional sports usually pack up and leave home to play in distant lands. Draft day decisions can send California beach dudes packing off to the frigid Northeast or Alberta farm boys heading for the sunny shores of Miami, but a few get to play the pro game in the region they've always called home. From member station KUOW in Seattle, John Moe has this report.
Play defense, you know, cut down turnover. We can go
NFL rookie cornerback Marcus Trufant grew up in Tacoma, Washington, played at Washington State University, and was drafted last May by the Seattle Seahawks. Now, number 23 is closely watched by family and friends at every Seahawks home game.
I have probably the most friends and family at each game. I got a little section of 23 jerseys that be up in the corner, probably about 25 people in the game. So I got a lot of love, a lot of support out here, and I love playing in my home state.
As a high first-round draft pick, he received a handsome signing bonus. But for Trufant, local legend status means funneling some of that money right over to the ticket office to get his people in the seats.
That's on me. I worked out a little plan. I got some season tickets, so it's not like 30 people ain't coming up to me every week and asking me for tickets. So kind of got it planned out. But, I support I sponsor the people coming to the games, basically.
But when the game's over and you're only 30 miles up Interstate 5 from your hometown, you tend to hear some highly personal post-game analysis from friends and family. Fortunately, Trufant has had an impressive rookie season.
It always makes you feel a little bit better when you can go and say, when I've been playing all right, I've been playing Good. Instead of people coming at you saying, man, you've been playing okay, but, you know, you got burned and this and that. You know, you hear that from your friends, but, I mean, it's always a little bit better when you've been doing good. The people that are closest to you are always most critical of you. I got brothers, and they be talking about me all the time, but it's always in good fun.
For pro athletes coming back to their hometowns with other teams, a little bit of criticism from those who know you best can be pretty refreshing. Atlanta Hawks guard Jason Terry grew up in Seattle and sports a tattoo on his chest that reads simply 206, Seattle's area code. Terry says that he can always count on a few old teammates from Franklin High to be in the crowd, as they were on the Hawks' recent road trip through the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I had like four or five, so, you know, that's always a good feeling, you know, to have the guys come out and support me. My high school coach sitting right behind the bench, like always, Lou Hobson. Every time out, he was telling me, stay focused, you know, follow through on your shot, or they're going to press next. So he was always coaching me, you know, throughout.
New Jersey Nets power forward Brian Scalabrine hails from Enumclaw, Washington, a rural suburb outside Seattle. He says that when he comes through town, playing the actual games is the easy part.
When you go out there and play, it's just a normal game. You know, you want to play well when you come home, but it's more of a, like a kind of distraction to do the tickets and all that stuff beforehand. But when you go out there and play, it's not a big difference. But my teammates gave me their tickets, and they did a good job, and I didn't really have to come out of my pocket at all.
Even with the demanding NBA schedule, Scalabrine still finds a way to make it back to Enumclaw when the Nets play the Seattle Supersonics. On November 24th, he made a quick visit to Mom's kitchen with a rookie teammate from Bosnia.
Last night, I went home and got a home-cooked meal, and, you know, just spent a little bit of time last night, and then today I basically just shoot around basketball stuff. But last night, you know, as we got in, I went to see my family. My man right here, Zoran Planina, he came with me and got him a home-cooked meal.
For those not lucky enough for invitations to Mom's house, Brian Scalabrine is ready with a credit card at local restaurants.
Most of the guys that I hang with in high school are aspiring coaches, so it doesn't pay well at first. And, you know, they helped me a lot, you know, growing up and just playing a game. And, you know, it's easier for me just to pick the check up. They're rooting for the Nets, all of them, or else I won't get them tickets.
Marcus Trufant says that while there is a lot of scrutiny for hometown pros, he's become comfortable with all of Tacoma watching him.
You know what? I can't see them, really, but I know they're there. So when I know their eyes are on me, every time after the game, they say, I saw you do this, I saw you do that. They're sitting there looking at me in the binoculars even. It's a pressure, but at the same time, I feel like it's working in my favor. I know I got a lot of support.
For only a game, I'm John Moe in Seattle.
Balaton number 8, Luke Rittenauer, is first. That is the 14th foul in the quarter called against the Suns.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Boy, was Purdue basketball's face red because of a bureaucratic snafu at Yorktown High School in Indiana. A 5'6" chess player who doubles on flute in the marching band was offered a basketball scholarship to Purdue. The lad's name is Jason Smith, a name he shares with the 6'6" point guard who averaged 26 points and 11 assists per game for Yorktown's basketball team, the guy Purdue had intended to recruit. Said Smith the lesser, I don't feel bad at all about keeping the scholarship. I've studied hard and I have a 3.8 GPA. The other Jason gets a 2.5 and he gets a full ride because he can put a stupid orange ball in a hoop. This story came to us courtesy of the Hoosier Gazette, Indiana's first source for inaccurate news since 2003.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headline. There's shocking news from the North Pole. The 243rd annual reindeer games are on hold after several vials labeled lichen juice were allegedly found in Prancer's locker. Many fear the vials contain THG, the so-called designer steroid. But initial tests were delayed after Santa's anti-doping elves made merry and lost the first batch of samples in a magical snowdrift. Prancer and his agent, Mossy Staghorn, refrained from comment. But old St. Nick himself answered questions about the brewing scandal at a press conference this morning.
Well, this is very, very disappointing. But Mrs. Claus and I still choose to see the silver lining in all of this. I mean, if those reindeer games are canceled because of doping, there will be plenty of caribou tartare for our Christmas Eve feast.
The first round of tests are expected later today, after which a decision will be made regarding the fate of this year's reindeer games. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Everyone knows Allen Iverson leads the NBA in points per game this season, but who leads the league in Taoist wisdom? Coming up on Only a Game, we'll have the answer, and it's not Phil Jackson. But first, it's time for another quiz. Which sports league was rescued from bankruptcy by three fans who had a little money to spare? Need a hint? Membership in said league has reached an all-time high mark. Television ratings in the all-important 18 to 24 demographic have rolled to an 80% increase and revenues up by 100%. Still striking out? From Uncasville, Connecticut, Only a Game's Karen Given has the answer.
Ladies and gentlemen, before you are 12 of the greatest bowlers in the world. Let's set them off with a nice round of applause.
In an arena that seats thousands, the Professional Bowlers Association kicks off its first major of the season, the Tournament of Champions at Mohegan Sun. Two seasons ago, this event was canceled for lack of support. 4 years ago, on the day former Microsoft executives Chris Peters, Mike Slade, and Rob Glazer bought the PBA, the tour lost what was then its last sponsor. Many observers called the league a charity case and described the new owners as sentimental fans. But Chris Peters says he saw the league as a promising, albeit risky, investment.
I have the saying that there is not a worldwide surplus of upright standing pins that need knocking down. I mean, although we love bowling, it's a horrible charity. I mean, you know, you should give your money to cancer things or AIDS things or something. I mean, but you don't give it to bowling leagues. And it turned out, I mean, irony of ironies, is of the investments people were making in early January 2000, this one has been one of the very best.
While other professional sports leagues have faced lackluster ticket sales, dwindling sponsorship money, and labor troubles, the PBA has built success around a more predictable season and a regular live television slot on ESPN. But the most important step, Peters says, was taking the league out of the 1950s.
When we came there and did the due diligence, it wasn't like we saw everything being run perfectly. But when we went there, I mean, I was expecting to go in there and fire the marketing department and find out that there wasn't one, you know. So the gamble was effectively that if we ran this thing like every other sports league is running in the United States circa 2000, 2001, could it be successful? I mean, we own the entire league. We can change the rules. So that was the attractive part.
Peters didn't just hire a marketing department. He hired executives straight from one of sport's most successful marketing giants, Nike. And the rules started changing right away. Head-to-head elimination matches were scheduled, prize money more than doubled. And for the first time next year, the tour will be limited to the top 60 bowlers, a decision Peters says hasn't been popular with some of the players.
I don't think these guys saw themselves as professional athletes, although they definitely are. And it's sort of like, hey boys, I got some good news for you. This is going to be a real sports league. But the bad news is it's going to be a real sports league. This is no goofing around, you know. So, you know, I'm starting to see that some guys are responding to the pressure really well and some guys, frankly, aren't.
Danny Wiseman, a 14-year veteran of the tour, feels the pressure and thrives on it. And after 10 years of being subjected to a dress code that hadn't changed since the 1950s, he was quick to cast off his polo shirts and conservative haircut when the new owners came on.
I always wear the killer clothes. Actually, right now, I have on the pants are actually slacks, but they look like leather. Got them in Vegas. Vegas got everything. And the shirt, realistically, it's just kind of like a button-down retro with some tribal on it, red and black.
It's not just the clothes that have changed. Bowlers have been encouraged to play up to the crowd and be more emotional. And like Pete Weber, the league's most notorious bad boy,
Wiseman looks forward to being under the bright lights of the live television broadcast.
Create the good bad. Every sport's got it. You know, I don't like him. Well, I do. You know what? Me, my personality, I'm going to let it rip. You know, what happens, happens. You know, there's certain guys, I'm sure, that the owners cringe when they make a show. But you can't deny their talent. Other guys are just, you know, if they could handpick who they want every week, I know who would be on the show every week. But you can't do that.
Professionals, we will now be turning your lanes on for 15 minutes of warm-up.
As the pros get ready, former Swooshster and current PBA President CEO Steve Miller still can't believe he's here.
I've sat at Wimbledon and the French Open and World Cup and NCAA Finals, and I have to admit that I didn't think 3 years ago I'd be at, you know, City Tech bowling lanes in God knows what city. So it has been illuminating. So.
Now, I mean, do you ever see the day? I mean,
yes. Yes, I do.
Any day.
I think if you're going to ask me, and I apologize for interrupting, if you're asking me, do I see this turning into an arena, big activity? Do I see, you know, hundreds of thousands of people? I don't know. I think our audience is probably at this point 10,000 people, but 10,000 people is a long way from the 200 that used to be there before, and what it could be, who knows.
This Friday afternoon crowd is still a long way from the loud, raucous fans Miller covets. One man asks, jokingly, should we do the wave? While others seem focused on the good old days.
I've been bowling since 1958. I'm really old now. And that's the truth. And see Carmen Savino down there? Mm-hmm. He used to come to Silver Lane in East Hartford and give lessons for us bowlers back in the 60s. That's when it was really good.
Mary Lou Rowe is one of the few to make some noise, letting out a tentative good one, Chris, every time her favorite bowler, Chris Barnes, rolls a strike. But not everyone is happy about her exuberance.
They won't let me holler. My husband say something to me because I said, yeah, Chris. He doesn't like that.
Well, I have it straight from the president of the PBA.
Yeah.
Holler away.
Oh, really?
You have permission.
Okay, I will. I will.
I will. Randy Peterson! Let's get it on!
By Sunday's TV broadcast, Connecticut fans have learned to cheer, though the broadcasters continually remind the folks at home that bowling is really exciting.
You want drama? You want pressure? Folks, don't go anywhere. Buckle up. You've got it.
Bowling's detractors have yet to be proven wrong. Despite a $30 million cash infusion over the past few years, the PBA is still losing money. That's expected to turn around this year. And Steve Miller estimates the PBA is worth 10 to 12 times its $5 million purchase price. Now that the outcome is looking brighter, Miller says the owners aren't entertaining new investment offers.
Would we do it again? Absolutely. Do we think it's gained traction? Absolutely. Are there people that want to join? Absolutely. And now we're not sharing it. So we feel very good about where we are.
For his part, Chris Peters is all smiles as he chats and jokes with the bowlers he used to only see on television. Just don't make the mistake of asking him if this experience has been fun.
No. I have a million people depending on us to save the sport they love. So fun isn't the first word that comes to your mind. It was a tremendous sense of responsibility. You know, it's like a parent having a child, you know, suddenly no more goofing off here. This is for real. This is these people's lives. So it's been incredibly rewarding, but not necessarily incredibly fun.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Uncasville, Connecticut.
Professionals, please hold up. Orbit is now over. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, they'll be bowling a best of five match play. The first bowler to win three games.
Now in his sophomore season with the Houston Rockets, Yao Ming, the 7-foot-5-inch center from Shanghai, is perhaps the world's best-known NBA player. His skills are considerable and his potential is extraordinary, and Oliver Chin, the author of a new book entitled The Tao of Yao, maintains that Yao has also become, quote, an authentic teacher of Taoist values to an awestruck yet accepting world. Oliver Chin joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Mr. Chin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Given the size of Yao Ming's audience, I can see why marketers have concluded that, quote, Yao could become a sports marketing icon. But what led you to see Yao as a teacher as well?
Well, I think it's pretty unusual now to see athletes as role models, even though that's how they became so famous and such celebrities in our culture over the last few decades. There's just been a string of high-profile incidents from Kobe Bryant on down, which has tended to, you know, take the bloom off the rose. But I do think as Yao became really well-known here in the States last year, after really having a huge amount of expectation as well as skepticism result from his being drafted number one by the Houston Rockets, he was turning skeptics into believers. And at that point, sort of midway through the year, I realized that there was a story here which was far beyond how many points or rebounds he was getting any particular game. And I thought, as he was confronting the press, talking to them in a way which seemed somewhat refreshing but almost ordinary and honest, that here was a man who was really like Eddie Murphy coming to America, but showing people a face of not only an athlete but also a person, which struck a chord not only with fans here but fans worldwide. And I thought he was reaching some sort of deeper common human understanding, which somehow seems foreign in today's world of professional sports.
What is Yao Ming's history as an actual student of the Tao? Do you know that?
Yeah, I don't really know that. I'm really doing a lot of inference at this point. But having grown up myself as a third-generation Chinese-American, I can identify with them to a certain extent in the idea that in the culture, even as it's become sort of assimilated here in the States, that certain things are almost taken for granted and not really even ascribed to Taoism per se. So a lot of things I discovered as I was really digging a little bit deeper into not only what he was saying, but how a lot of what he said and did was rooted in the concepts of this Chinese philosophy created in 300 BC. Really, you don't have to be a scholar of Taoism to have really imbibed a lot of the principles on a common, familial, or social level.
When he was first trying to get used to life in the NBA last season, Yao said at one point, quote, everything is happening too rapidly, too fast. That sounds as if his philosophy wasn't sufficient to the task he was facing. Has he managed to slow things down, do you think?
Probably not. The world just keeps getting faster and faster, and I sort of liken him to being in the eye of the hurricane. And when you're outside the hurricane, things just seem chaotic. Things are being ripped apart. There seems to be no order in the world. It's really unpredictable. But being in the eye, that's where the calmness is. Mm-hmm. And I think he embodied that. And as you become more famous, it only I think, becomes more intense. But I don't think anyone would have been prepared to have been thrust in the position that he was in. Despite all the elements being thrown at him, I think he displayed somewhat of an uncommon demeanor and humility, which really points to the teachings that Lao Tzu wrote, you know, 2.5 millennia ago about how to keep in balance, keep in harmony, and understand the broader context of life, of which, in this case, sports or putting a round ball through a round hoop is really kind of a small matter.
You characterize Yao at one point in the book as, quote, the anti-center in the Taoist sense. Is that what you mean? He's in the eye of the hurricane, but somehow not the center of things? I'm not saying this very well. Help me out here.
Yeah, I think that points to really what people would consider a contradiction in Western terms, but in an Eastern way of thinking is really holistic. And, you know, if you're a center, you're the go-to guy. You have to say, give me the ball and get out of the way, and you need to be willing to demand from your teammates to be the center of attention and the center of the offense and the center of everything. But I think Yao's approach is fundamentally different. I think he can achieve the same goals. He openly stated that, you know, he believes in teamwork. And with that approach, he's sort of the anti-center because Yao passes, he's willing to deflect praise, he's willing to accept criticism. He wants to be a cog in the wheel. And in the Taoist sense, the cog of the wheel is the center, and that's what makes everything revolve. So he doesn't want to be a black hole taking all the balls for himself and just doing all the scoring. He wants to make things happen as a pivot. And in that sense, he's not the center, but he is. And that really points to this Taoist idea of how opposites are really complementary.
At one point, you quote Yao Ming in the book as saying, "I've been asked so many questions, everybody knows everything." He sounds dismayed at this development, and as you've pointed out, there's no real parallel in his experience in China to what he encountered in the NBA. Is he dismayed, or has he kind of managed to maintain that innocence?
Well, I think it'll be an ongoing challenge for him, but I think for him, what really interested me from the very beginning was, I wouldn't say an innocence per se, but it's really a directness, a frankness, not really a poeticness to his comments, but really a sense that a statement is more than just a regurgitation of fact, and an opinion is more than just one man's prejudice. There's a continuum here of human thought across cultures and across time, and even across human activity. And I think in that, he is not really, you know, the paragon of human virtue for me or for anyone, but he becomes a mirror to our own ways of living, our own ways of seeing not only him, but also ourselves and our activities. And I think that's sort of the kernel of truth, which I want to get at, and how we spend so much of our time reading at the newspaper, looking at television, you know, dissecting the preferences or the peccadilloes of other people, but he becomes sort of a mirror to our own souls and seeing how, well, you know, what do we want to do? What do we have to say? And how can we do those things better ourselves?
Oliver Chin is the author of The Tao of Yao, subtitled Insights from Basketball's Brightest Big Man, published by Frog Limited. Mr. Chin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on the show.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cub fans dance on Waveland Avenue.
Reverse the curse, Bailey!
The Bulls basketball dynasty begins with a shot.
Here's Michael at the foul line. A shot on Elo. Goal! The Bulls win it!
Can't come up with anything for the Blackhawks or White Sox at the moment. I'm Scott Simon. Tune in for Chicago sports. And maybe sports from beyond. And, oh, right, we almost forgot the news on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Steve Brown with the sports headlines. The 243rd annual Reindeer Games are on again after test results concluded that vials belonging to Prancer did not contain the performance-enhancing steroid THG, but in fact was lichen juice. Prancer is considered a favorite in endurance grazing. Blitzen and Comet are expected to medal in the two-on-two caribou football tournament, but all eyes will be on Rudolph, who only moments ago acknowledged that the pressure to win his 40th consecutive nasal navigation competition has been overwhelming.
Sure, I'm the only reindeer with a luminescent proboscis, but that doesn't guarantee a win. I mean, what if Dancer, that klutz, slips and breaks my nose again? Then I'd really see red. Get it?
Rudolph's longtime agent, Doe Big Bucks, also announced that her client is very close to securing a lucrative multi-year deal with Reebok Hoofwear. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Brown in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a seasonal competition that may enable you to divest yourself of an unwanted gift. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me to talk about the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Why are you looking at me like that? Don't be divesting yourself.
On Thursday, Bud Selig ended talks between Alex Rodriguez and the Boston Red Sox after the team failed to restructure A-Rod's contract to the liking of the union. Red Sox team president and CEO Larry Lucchino said afterward, quote, "The players' association's intransigence and arbitrary nature of its action are responsible for the deal's demise." Is it that simple?
All right. Now, everyone has established their manhood in public, and they can put the tape measures away, and now it's time to get the deal done. I still think this will happen. The whole transaction was a special circumstance because Bud Selig, in an attempt to help the Bobos he put in place to run the Boston Red Sox, allowed Alex Rodriguez and his agent to talk directly to them. This engages the collective bargaining agreement. This engages the Players Association. All of this is not surprising. The fact is that this deal will get done because if it doesn't, it leaves two of Major League Baseball's franchises, including one which the commissioner of baseball is quite devoted to up here in Boston, it leaves both of them in chaos. Mm. So this will get done quietly and quickly and to everyone's satisfaction at some point over the weekend, I believe.
Almost as soon as Roger Clemens retired, we began hearing rumors that he would come back and pitch for the Houston Astros. This week, Tom Hicks, the owner of the Texas Rangers, met privately with Clemens. Have we a Lone Star State bidding war in the making?
Well, who knows? I mean, there's absolutely no telling what Tom Hicks is up to. He's going to get rid of Alex Rodriguez and bring in, you know, Manny Ramirez, and now he's, you know, probably bored because he hasn't done anything idiotic in the last 3 or 4 days. He's going to engage in a bidding war with the Houston Astros over Roger Clemens, who may not even pitch at all. A lot of the momentum behind the story was gathered when Andy Pettit signed away from the Yankees with the Houston Astros. Pettit has looked upon Clemens as kind of a hero and role model and professional idol while they were at the Yankees, so this would indicate that he might be interested in pitching in nearby Houston. Other than that, I mean, there's not much else to say except never take any professional athlete's retirement seriously until they're throwing the dirt in the hole.
Speaking of bidding, Charlie, yesterday the so-called Bartman ball sold at auction for $106,000. That'll make a nice stocking stuffer for some lucky Marlins fan, won't it?
Some Cubs fan is an idiot. This is not even that important a ball. It's certainly not as important as the ball that Bill Buckner muffed that was sold to Charlie Sheen for almost $94,000. And not only that, it went $600 past the ball that Mickey Mantle hit for a home run in 1964. The Cubs could still have won that game. This is not that big a deal. The only reason that it's a big deal is because it was on national television. It was made an event. Steve Bartman became a famous guy. He's at the 15-and-a-half-minute mark now, so we don't hear about him. But the idea that that this ball is a significant piece of baseball history is laughable.
Two of this season's 28 bowl games are now behind us. Would you care to report on the ultra-thrilling events that have already transpired?
Well, actually, I would not care to report on the New Orleans Bowl, so I'm not going to do that. But Miami of Ohio won its 13th straight game. They beat Louisville. Ben Roethlisberger, who is a quarterback about whom you are going to hear a lot over the next couple of years, had a terrific year and a terrific final game. He threw for 376 yards and four touchdowns, and the four touchdowns were all in the first half. He may be the best quarterback in America.
Pro football lost one of its all-time greats this week, Charlie. Otto Graham, who quarterbacked the Cleveland Browns with spectacular success from 1946 until his retirement in 1955, died on Wednesday. He was 82 years old. One appreciation that I read of Otto Graham called him, quote, personified perfection. Does that sound about right?
Or he could be perfection personified.
Either
depending.
Way.
But the thing that was amazed me, and I have to admit Otto Graham fell off my radar screen a long time ago, his regular season record was 105-17-4. That is amazing. Those are numbers that are way beyond the likes of Johnny Unitas, Joe Namath, Joe Montana, anybody.
Early this week, the National Football League fined Saints receiver Joe Horn $30,000 for unauthorized use of a cell phone after his touchdown against the Giants on Sunday. His agent, Ralph Vitolo, has called the fine, quote, excessive. Is there any point to arguing with the league about this matter?
No, because this is the league that actually employs people to go out on the road in cold weather and stand on the sideline and make sure guys have their socks pulled up correctly. I thought the phone gag was hilarious. I thought Chad Johnson running back and pulling a sign out of a snowdrift saying, "Dear NFL, please don't fine me," again, was even funnier.
And he got fined, too.
There's a nice little element of giddy rebellion to these events, and I don't have a problem with it.
After his team's 45-7 loss to the Saints on Sunday, Giants linebacker Mike Barrow used a rape analogy to describe New York's loss. Will he be fined?
I think he undoubtedly will be fined, but between that and Matt Millen calling somebody a gender identity slur, why don't they just all let him take out the cell phones and take out the little signs and make everybody laugh and be happy and not talk? If you allow them to talk, bad things happen.
Speaking of the NFL's sensitivity to women, the Lingerie Bowl, a pay-per-view alternative to the Super Bowl halftime show, took a hit this week when Dodge bailed out. Maybe if you and I continue to talk about this event for the next few weeks, the whole event will be bailed out upon by everybody who might sponsor it.
Well, those of us who are waiting with bated breath for the Lingerie Bowl don't want it corporatized anyway. I mean, there's too many important sports events in the calendar that have been corporatized. I think they should go without a sponsor. I think public broadcasting is waiting for this event.
I think maybe it's moving towards an event that will feature fully clad women bashing NFL and Dodge executives over the head with 2x4s. Finally, Charlie, the Battle of the Hockey Gladiators, set for Grand Forks, North Dakota in September, will feature hockey fights and no hockey. Good idea?
You know, sooner or later, every joke that Rodney Dangerfield tells comes true. This way, you can actually go to the fight and see a hockey game break out.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and he never resorts to thuggery when he joins me each week on Only a Game. Happy holidays, Charlie.
God bless us, everyone.
Buddy's real talent was beating people up. His heart wasn't in it, but the crowd ate it up. Through peewees and juniors and midgets and mites, he must have racked up more than 300 fights. Till a scout from the Flames came down from Saskatoon. Said there's always room on a team for a goon. Son, we've always got room for a goon.
The aforementioned Lingerie Bowl is apparently intriguing you as well. Howard Bennett, who hears the show on WNJN in Trenton, New Jersey, wrote, "Charlie hits the nail on the head again. I wonder if the Lingerie Bowl will surpass the Super Bowl." Regarding said Lingerie Bowl, Jay Goodrich, a WBUR listener, opined, "Women have really come a long way. No wonder that finally the mainstream sports establishment is giving them credit they deserve. And who may we thank for this extravaganza? Dodge, that's who. The day when Dodge will rescue the WUSA can't be far in the future." Jerry Kalish, who listens to the show online, emailed to say, "I like Only a Game for its offbeat features that you don't get on other shows. However, there are two things I find annoying. Bill Littlefield's constant cackling laugh, which sounds ridiculously phony, and Charlie Pierce shouting to the point where you almost have to mute the volume to get his voice down to a comfortable level. Probably a problem with his computer. Better check for magneto trouble, or maybe it's the distributor, maybe the coil." Of John Moe's profile of Shayna Heavey, the achondroplastic high school lacrosse player in Seattle, Jeff Bell of Heartland, Vermont, wrote, "The report was done with gentle honesty. What a gift you provide by finding what is truly important in sports. Her coaches, teammates, parents, and most of all the young athlete herself demonstrate what courage is really about." Don West of Plattsburgh, New York, wrote to suggest that Only a Game should recheck the program's address book. In a story about street hockey in Washington, D.C., we apparently had Mr. Bush residing at 1400 rather than 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I wonder if that was a Freudian slip. Finally, there were numerous inquiries about the music in the annual Only a Game gift guide, which we featured in last week's show. All the music is listed on the website, onlyagame.org, this week. Laurel Carroll, who hears the show on Vermont Public Radio, wrote, "The woman singing All I Want for Christmas is not Mariah Carey. Who is it?" The singer is Julie London, and the song is actually entitled I'd Like You for Christmas.
I'd like you for Christmas.
come true.
Now I'm on? Oh, sorry. A little trouble concentrating there. You can send your questions, corrections, or comments to us via the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Overland Mail will reach us at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
And he remembers that I'd like you for Christmas, New Year's, Easter, too.
Are you the not-so-hungry recipient of a traditional holiday fruitcake this Yuletide season? Well, you're not alone. A recent survey suggests that less than a third of all fruitcakes sold annually are actually eaten by those who receive them. What happens to the rest? Well, if Drew Cerza has his way, they'll end up in Buffalo, where on December 30th, they'll be the featured food in the first ever officially sanctioned fruitcake eating contest. Drew joins us now from his office in Buffalo. Drew, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
This is a pretty sweet deal.
It is, isn't it?
I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself.
Well, you know, we also run the National Buffalo Wind Festival, which is a very hot deal. So It's about time we had a sweet deal.
Drew, before we get into the mysteries of the fruitcake and things of that nature, this event is going to feed hungry people a lot of things other than fruitcake, right?
Yes, the fruitcake is really like the icon of an unwanted food.
A distinction of sorts.
And we all have unwanted food in the pantry that's basically good food. So the whole message is, let's help feed the hungry during the holiday time. And let's clear the cupboards and send all our unwanted food to your local food bank. Send your unwanted fruitcakes to Buffalo, New York, And we will get them out to the hungry in Western New York, maybe the more recent ones, but the ones from back around 2001. And we think we're going to get them back to as far as the Reagan administration. Those are the ones that we're going to eat competitively and have some fun with it.
I'm really glad that you're including other foods, because otherwise this whole event might constitute cruelty to those who have less and least.
Somebody told me, you know, the people that eat these fruitcakes in the 12-minute contest, you better be careful because they might bring their attorneys and sue you for cruel and unruly punishment.
Any problem finding people who will actually sit down and try to eat these things?
Actually, there's a circuit of eaters. Professional
eaters, excellent.
And they're actually excited to come in. The one lady who's coming in from Virginia, she's about 36 years old. She weighs about 98 pounds. She ate 134 chicken wings in 12 minutes in the Wing Festival.
Wow.
And she's actually excited to come in. Now, I don't know if you train for fruitcake eating, because I think this must have to be a first-time effort, because if you train for it, you might not want to eat them again.
Nobody's sure how much fruitcake a person can eat in 12 minutes, but estimates have come in from 6 to 8 pounds of the dense dessert.
Bill, here's my concern. I think fruitcakes are so dense, it's kind of like dog ears. For every one, you have seven. I actually ate my first piece of fruitcake the other day, and I'm 42 years old.
And you live to tell the tale.
Well, you know, they strapped me down, and I couldn't get out. I actually took two bites, too. That wasn't that bad.
There you go.
It wasn't bad. It's not my dessert of choice now, but it wasn't bad.
As part of running this event, have you researched the fruitcake? Do you know where the fruitcake was first invented?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. The fruitcake is actually tied into one of the seven wonders of the world. The fruitcake was invented in Egypt. And it was a gift that people would give to royalty, to pharaohs and kings and queens. Mm-hmm. I guess that's why we have pyramids. I guess the truth is those pyramids are really big storage facilities for all the unwanted fruitcakes from years past.
The mayor of Buffalo has apparently issued something called a fruitcake amnesty. You're going to have to explain to me what that is.
Well, you know what? There's so many fruitcakes out there. It's kind of like guns and not paying your taxes. There's a lot of people that don't want to admit to their friends, I've never eaten your fruitcake, and I've probably re-gifted it two or three times. I've gotten it back at the Santa Secret Exchange Program. So it's a way to turn your fruitcakes into buffalo, and there'll be no questions asked.
Now, did you expect the enormous response that you've gotten when you came up with this idea?
I'm going to be honest with you on this. I really did. I'll tell you why. I think during the holiday seasons, you know, it's such an emotional time for a lot of people. And we're all collecting toys for the needy and trying to feed the hungry and all that. We needed a funny story. I really think we all need a funny story to rally around and get some water cooler talk. I thought it would be big, but not this big. This is unbelievable.
Well, how many fruitcakes are we talking about in terms of those pouring into your office?
We've got a couple thousand so far. And actually, all the fruitcakes are sent to the local food bank of Western New York here in Buffalo.
I see.
But what we found is people are turning in their fruitcakes to their own food bank in their city.
Oh, good.
So it's really become a food raiser, let's call it, for cities across the country.
Now, Drew, my understanding is that the idea of the chicken wing eating contest was really a natural because everybody associates chicken wings with Buffalo.
Yes.
Any worry that this is going to succeed so magnificently that fruitcake will go beyond chicken wings and become the food of Buffalo?
I have to read a headline from a New York City newspaper. Buffalo wings, underneath it, nah, fruitcakes. So I think we could be known as the fruitcake capital of the world. Now, I don't know if that's good or bad, so we'll see what happens.
Are you guys going to have suggestions of sort of what you can put on fruitcake? To, I mean, a little whipped cream, a little ice cream, anything, you know, to kind of make it more palatable?
Well, I don't know if you ever read the ingredients of a fruitcake. They all differ based on the package.
Mm-hmm.
One had sulfur dioxide. Mm. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist or a scientist or a very smart guy, but I got to believe that's a crazy item they have in a fruitcake. You cannot go on an airplane with a fruitcake. They're so dense that it throws off the whole scanner. So you can't even travel on an airplane with them. That's what I was told.
Drew Cerza is organizing the first annual fruitcake eating contest in Buffalo, New York, scheduled for December the 30th. Drew, thank you for doing this wonderful work, and thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure, Bill.
To find out how to send your unwanted fruitcake to Buffalo, log on to our website at www.onlyagame.org.
Open this one first, Uncle Bob. Didn't I get this last year?
Didn't I get this last year?
Try to act surprised, Uncle Bob. But I got this last year.
But he got that last year.
A tie. Wider than a mile, with a pattern way out of style. With a pattern that's way out of style.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Jen Savio, Kathleen McKenna, Ted O'Brien, Keith Shields, and from Howard Gelman at KQED in San Francisco. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or peruse photos of Professional Bowlers Association stars, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from 14-year PBA veteran Danny Wiseman.
I don't like to look like a bowler, and I am.
Well, for heaven's sake, man, do something about it. There's still time. I'm Bill Littlefield. Happy holidays. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Surprise, surprise. A coupon for some fries. That was really very thoughtful, you guys. This last year.
Didn't I get this last year?
Didn't I get this last year?
Didn't I get this last year?
I'm sure I got this last year.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.